It's a Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories retold episode, taking an old episode from somewhere in the back catalog and popping it up to the top of the feed. About a year ago, we spent some time talking about an old Taylor Swift song and who she was referring to. She's telling a story about a musical legend. It's a little unclear as to, you know, in most cases, Taylor doesn't like to talk about who she's talking about. But we went real deep on this episode. We thought we'd pull that back up because, of course, as you know, unless you're living under a rock, if you pay attention to music at all, the Tortured Poets Department is now live. And I've listened to it, and it's fine. I'm sure I will like it more the more I listen to it. But yeah, it's a lot of Jack Antonoff, a little bit of Aaron Dessner from The National, and it's, you know, a whole lot of Taylor. She's got a couple guest spots. Post Malone shows up. Florence from Florence and the Machine shows up. And it's long. That's another thing that she does now, is still makes long albums because she's Taylor Swift and can do whatever she wants. So it's about an hour long, but it's got 16 tracks on it. You don't get that from very many people anymore. And I'm sure there will be lots of people talking about it and lots of commentary and lots of things said about it in the coming days. So I won't add to that noise. I will just say, let's celebrate the woman. Let's celebrate the day. And let's revisit an episode of the show where we dove deep on Taylor Swift and Bobby Gentry and fame. Enjoy. I want to slide backwards into the catalog of possibly the biggest musician alive on the planet today, Taylor Swift. Do you consider yourself a Swiftie?
No.
Like, do you enjoy it at all?
Oh, yeah. I saw a stadium show before the pandemic, and it was remarkably good for a stadium show. I thought it was great.
I have seen her twice. I have been in the pit both times, and it was delightful. I got named a Swiftie dad by MTV in 2015.
I put the link in the show notes.
Yeah. You don't remember this? Yeah. So
we talked about some of this Taylor Swift stuff when we met, but no, I can't remember.
So I saw her on the Best Tour, the 1989 tour. I saw her on the Speak Now tour as well. But on the 1989 tour, I had my then 7-year-old daughter with me, who now is a hardcore Swiftie. And she feels like she peaked a little early in her Swiftiedom, that she got to meet, you know, because we had the radio connections. She got to meet Taylor and hug her. Well, the famous story is that I took her backstage, and we were going through the meet and greet, and she walked up and gave Taylor a big hug, and Taylor said, "Hey, do you want your dad in on this picture too?" And Sadie looked straight at her in the eyes and said, "Nope." And she goes, "Oh, okay." So there is a picture of my daughter hugging the crap out of Taylor Swift, and I am not in the frame. But while we were in the arena, this guy was writing for MTV, and he comes up and is like, "Oh, hey, I see you're with your daughter. Do you want to do my Swiftie dad quiz?"
No,
and I was
way.
Like, "Okay." So he like asked me like 4 questions, and of course I knew them all because I worked in radio and I'm a music head, and all of those things combined.
You were a Swiftie dad.
I was
That's
a Swiftie
how you
dad.
Got chosen as a Swiftie dad. So, God, how did I not know this?
Yeah, what? So the picture's not in the show. The picture's not in the article anymore, but the article is still online, and I put it in the show notes. So if you want to go see it and read it, you can see that I made my daughter a real nerd because she told the reporter about who produced her favorite song on the record, because, you know, she's my kid. So cheers to that. But in short, yeah, I've always been a Taylor fan. I was into those country records sort of when we were working them back in the day. And, as I said, I've raised someone who really loves and respects her and is borderline obsessed. So there's a lot of Taylor in my life. For our purposes today, we're going to honor the Eras Tour approach that Taylor herself is now taking. And we're going to go way back. We're going to go before Midnights. We're going to go before the Pandemic records. We're going to go before Lover, before Reputation, even before My Beloved 1989, which I count unapologetically and unironically as one of the best albums ever made. Today, we're going to go back to 2012's Red. Now, if you don't know Taylor's catalog or career, let me just give you some rough context that I think is important to this story.
This is where all these very different important characters get involved with this story. It's like a big turning point.
Yeah. So this is a little bit of a sliding doors moment. I have to squint to remember this, but working in country music when this record came out, there were thoughts that she might be committing career suicide, like that this might be marking the beginning of the end for her. Of course, it didn't. We now see in retrospect that this was a great move for her, but she was actively turning away from the country market that had raised her, and she'd done the first 3 records with this guy Nathan Chapman, And oh my God, I have a Nathan Chapman story that you're not going to believe.
All right.
So I hung out with Nathan Chapman. We were kids together. This was a thing that happened. And I don't think I've ever told you this.
No. You've never told me this.
So Nathan is the son of Steve and Annie Chapman. And Steve and Annie Chapman were evangelical Christian singers who went around to churches and performed for like a love offering. Once again, we've made the Lord the last thing on our minds. But there's still time for a circle of two. A circle of two. You and I must rediscover why we're given to each other. In a circle of two. A circle of two. And they would often take their kids with them, Nathan and Heidi. And my parents would host them, and we would all go to dinner after the show with Nathan and Heidi Chapman. And my dad called me one day, like 10 years ago, and was like, you remember Nathan Chapman? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, I'm pretty sure he's producing all of Taylor Swift's records. And I was like, no way. And I went and looked it up, and sure enough, man, Nathan Chapman. So Nathan Chapman, Brian, we used to hang out, which is a totally weird thing. Anyway, I just thought that was a wow. fun thing I had to throw in here, because I don't think I've ever told you that.
Wow, you should have made a record with Nathan Chapman.
Apparently. So
you should have. Or maybe Max Martin.
Well, and that's what happens, right? So this is the record where right. Nathan Chapman's still in the room, but she calls Scott Borchetta and is like, this guy Max Martin, do you think you can get him to come and work with me? And so they do it.
We mentioned this when we were talking about Shania a few weeks ago, that there's a major debt to be paid to Shania in the way that Taylor chooses to operate.
Absolutely.
From here forward and trying to be herself. So I know this, I'm not a Swiftie, but I know enough about that Speak Now was the record where it showed like here she can write songs.
Red Album
had different things on it. Like it was a
different
style. It was a departure record.
And you already said, like, so Max Martin's in the room with Shellback, his partner, and they produced 22 I Knew You Were Trouble and We're Never Getting Back Together, which are big pop songs. And
yeah, it's like huge.
Again, you have to remember coming from country radio what it was like to hear these songs and be like, we can't play these on country radio. Like, I remember those conversations happening in the hallways. She also starts working with other producers and writers. Dan Wilson is in the room from Semisonic, who I love. I think he's an excellent songwriter. Butch yeah. Walker, who has shaped a lot of pop, well, really 10 years ago or so was shaping a lot of pop music. And he was in a group 20 years ago called The Marvelous Three. Which, if you've yeah. not heard those power pop records, do yourself a favor.
And Butch Walker's solo records are really good too. By the
so
way,
so good, just dude.
Heads
so
up. Good. It's like it's really when you hear the Butch Walker records, you'll be like, okay, wait. So this dude was hanging out with Max Martin,
yeah,
and Taylor Swift,
yeah,
in a room.
I mean, and so that's the thing.
They were going to make great records.
You see this now even more, but she's a unifier, right? I mean, at this point in her career, she's gotten so big that anyone and everyone is interested in working with her, and so she's brought all these people along. But, you know, this record had Jackknife Lee working with her because he's from Snow Patrol, and the lead yeah. singer does a duet, yeah. but then he actually helps produce that record. Jeff Basker, who she hears... And he comes into the song we're going to talk about. He's an important part of it because she hears We Are Young by Fun. And you know how that song is all built around the drums? She's like, I want that drum sound. So she calls the guy who made that drum sound, Jeff Basker, and he gets to work on the record. So I set all of this up here because it's at this big juncture in her career when she's navigating towards this big risky move that she quietly writes and records a song that becomes track 13. That record was so long. Track 13 on Red, a song called The Lucky One. Are you familiar at all with this?
It's the one where the drums go ding 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 ding.
Yeah. It's
that song, whatever.
It's the Jeff Basker drums. Yeah. So she's credited as the sole writer on this. And this song is a story song. And it tells a story about a woman who becomes very successful as an entertainer and then gets disillusioned. So I'll read a few lyrics here. Now it's big black cars and Riviera views, and your lover in the foyer doesn't even know you, and your secrets end up splashed on the news front page, and they tell you that you're lucky, but you're so confused because you don't feel pretty, you just feel used. Now, that's a pretty common story and a very common pop song theme, right? Being disillusioned with fame.
Right.
What sets the lucky one apart is how the song ends. So the woman at the center of the story chooses to walk away from her success at the height of her powers and end everything on her own terms. So first, I think you can see this as Taylor reflecting on where she is at this point in her career, right? I mean,
yeah.
She's young.
How old is she?
Yeah, how old is she?
22, 23 at this point? Yeah. Yeah. She's born in 89. That's the easy thing to remember. And this is 2012. Right. But she's already found huge success. And I think she knows she's taking a risk and that this could like launch her to be bigger than she could ever imagine over the next decade. She could be doing three nights in every major metropolitan area in their biggest stadium, or it could result in this crash and burn scenario where she's done.
And I will say this for our listeners that have no familiarity with what it's like to be in country radio. I remember around this time, the vitriol around her with her popularity was nasty.
And so she takes more control of her songwriting, and she takes more control of the artistic direction with beckoning Max Martin to her through Scott Borchetta. And this is a big gamble, and it could go very, very wrong. What's captivating to a certain ear or level of fan is who she might be referring to in this last verse. It was a few years later, and I showed up here. It sounds like she's talking about herself now. And they still tell the legend of how you disappeared, how you took the money and your dignity, and you got the hell out. So it begs this question. Is this song based on a true story? And that's the rock and roll wormhole that I want to dive into today.
Ooh, how super fun.
So here's the thing about Taylor, living with a hardcore Swiftie who's a teenager. If you lived with someone who was into this whole thing about Midnights coming out, I mean, my daughter was telling me the Instagram rumors every single day about what the track titles meant and what order they were going to be in and what that meant and who the songs were about. And there's just all of this significance to everything. She'd put up a picture on Instagram and people would be dropping all these fan theories on what it meant because of the way she was holding the camera or the color of the tint that was on the picture, right? So she's always been great at this sort of mystique spinning. And no, she's never said directly who she's referring to. I think partly for the mystique, but I also can speculate. Right. I think there's another layer of this. And this might be giving her a ton of credit. But I do think that she's always been smart and thoughtful. And I think she might say that the point of this is that it happens to a lot of women. It's not just an anecdotal story, but this is actually a pattern that happens in entertainment of this sort of what you already alluded to, of what was happening to her in country music, right? Of just this vitriol that was being thrown at her and this disrespect as a woman in entertainment.
Let's get into the rumor and innuendo. So who's this song about, dude?
So I'll tell you the popular and accepted theories. If you were to just get on the internet right now and do your own research very quickly, you're going to come up with two names, Joni Mitchell and Kim Wilde. Let's start with Joni. I feel like you can get us where we need to go with Joni. Can you give us a primer?
I have a divided household here, man, where someone does not like Joni Mitchell.
But listen, really?
going to California is Page and Plant had a like everyone else had a crush on her, and that's the song.
You're telling me Going to California by Led Zeppelin is about going to California to see Joni Mitchell?
Do you know how many songs have been written about Joni Mitchell? Do you know how many times Joni Mitchell played that song, breaking up about David Crosby, right in front of David Crosby twice?
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that. We talked about that on the David Crosby episode. Holy crap.
If Joni Mitchell had a wallet, it would say bad motherfucker on it. Nope. But Going to California, it's the tunings DADGBD.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's the dad. It's DAD. That sort of illustrates the thing. Like, she was she was doing alternate tunings.
That was one of her trademarks, was tuning her guitar. Do you know anything about the special guitar she had made?
It was like a Roland VG8.
I think that was like the virtual overlay they put on this. Like, she hires a guy like way before this sort of tech was just built in on the internet, or that you could just like go to the, you know, buy a thing on Amazon. She hired a guy like in the mid 90s to make her this Stratocaster style guitar that had this, it had software in it.
Right.
And so, it would allow it to change without her actually changing the tuning.
She was a badass like on every level. So in episode 114, we talked about Rick James. Joni was in that story.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Because that's a great episode. If you haven't heard, that's 114.
He goes to her house to meet Neil Young, because Neil Young's just like staying at Joni Mitchell's house.
The influence in connecting people is really interesting. And think about how she was at the center of CSNY. And there are some things where she just was always in the middle of that. But she was a Canadian, and she was in a Canadian nightclubs, and she was a songwriter. Initially, that was kind of the deal, but she got a record deal out of it, you know, to be a performer.
And then there's this wild career that starts of just absolute legendary recordings alongside all kinds of experimenting. Like, I forget how much she just threw the book out and did whatever she wanted through certain parts of her career.
Yeah, I completely forgot. Why didn't we talk about the jazz part first? We should just talk about the fucking jazz. So
she did an album with, like, not to step on you, she did an album with Charles Mingus. Like,
with Charles motherfucking Mingus, my favorite.
Which, and the, I think I own that record somewhere.
Two loves changing faces. Dismissals and grand embraces, like it was only a dance. We are survivors.
Put those two genres together, like it's, she stands alone in first.
Yeah, and so here's how this connects to the Taylor song. The question becomes, is she, who is being referred to as someone who took the money and walked away from her fame? And I would say only kind of. So in 1988, she records this album called Taming the Tiger. And in the early 2000s, she'll fulfill the rest of her recording contract by making albums that don't have new songs. She tells the press that one of these, an album called Travelogue, was going to be her final album. And there's a 2002 Rolling Stone interview where she complains about the music industry and she calls it a cesspool, right? So this is sort of this attitude of like, I'm packing up and leaving. She hints at one point, I think in that interview, that she might just start putting things out on the internet. That was a popular thing to drop in interviews around the year 2000. But none of this actually lasts very long. So she makes sort of a big deal. And then by 2007, she's got new material out. And through activism and weird quotes about Dylan being a thief, she sort of stays in the limelight. I'm just brushing over that, but we can talk about it if you want. And I don't really think it lines up with what the Lucky One is portraying. Also, in the last few years, I don't know if you knew this, Brandi Carlile has like made it a personal project of her own to hang out with Joni Mitchell and get her to like come out into public. And
yeah,
I think like in the next couple of weeks, they're doing a Joni Mitchell headlining event somewhere on the West Coast.
Yeah, she did the folk festival or the...
Yeah. Festival. She just showed up like in Brandi Carlile's slot, I think.
They recorded it too.
Which is wild. But I definitely think that Joni was an inspiration to Taylor.
So it makes sense, right? So the album's called Red and it's because of blue, right?
Yeah, and the album art is kind of similar. They're both sort of, it's a headshot at an angle sort of thing. Yeah. So I definitely think that she gets pulled into this conversation because of that. And there's no denying that a young, innovative woman with an acoustic guitar owes some homage to the great Joni Mitchell. But I don't think the Lucky One is really about Joni Mitchell. What's your relationship to Kim Wilde?
You know, by now, Brian, I think I've heard more bands play Kids in America than Kim Wilde, which is right?
You know, the thing that's lost on Americans is that Kim Wilde was bonkers huge in the UK. She holds the record for being the most charted British female solo act of the 1980s.
With how many hits?
17. She had 17 top 40 UK hits.
What? That's like Tina Turner US.
Dude, I know. And like no one knows that. People think she's the Kids in America girl.
Right. Yeah. See, did you hear me? I made fun of her. I was thinking about like Bowling for Soup playing it or something.
No, I know. It's wild. But
she's like rock and roll offspring because it's what are their names? They were in a band called the Vernon Girls.
Yeah, Joyce Baker, you got it. And then Marty Wilde was her dad.
Okay.
Marty Wilde was like a 1950s rock and roll dude. Kim herself will get signed at a pretty young age by a name that keeps coming up on this show when we talk British musicians, and that is Mickey Most.
I just like you, like for all of us to say Mickey Most as much as we can, just for a moment.
We do.
Are everyone ready?
I feel like
Mickey Most.
I feel like that name has come up on this show every week for like at least a month or two.
Fun to say. Okay,
so she cashes in on her connections too, right? So her dad and uncle will write all of her early 80s material. Think about that. And the success happens like really fast. Her very first single is Kids in America.
Did American audiences know that that was written by someone who was not American?
Right? Like, isn't that weird that it's Kids in America? I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't think if you had asked me a week ago if Kim Wilde was British, I would have said no. I would have said she was American based only on that song.
That is like her signature song here. That song was not like a top 20 hit in the US, but I bet that was like a top 5 hit in the UK or whatever.
Yeah, like it was number 2 in the UK singles chart, and then it was like top 5 in Germany, France, and Australia.
See, so in the US she's only known for that one song, really.
So I don't think the lucky one is about Kim Wilde at all, because Kim never really quits music. She actually does the opposite. In the early 2000s, she starts doing nostalgia tours. Like I didn't even know about this, but there was like a British nostalgia tour that runs in the early 2000s, and I guess it was like a thing that was just in Britain, and she's on it like the whole time, every year.
Why do you think her name gets associated with Joni?
Okay, so
I
wondered about that, because it seems, I mean, Joni Mitchell and Kim Wilde, I couldn't even draw a connection to those two if I was forced to. I don't know. You know, it's not like those two have something in common drawing them to this song. So how does she connect with Taylor, and how does she connect with the song itself? Two reasons, I think. One is that the melody of the song, The Lucky One, actually openly borrows from a Kim Wilde song that I wasn't familiar with. But it's a song called Four Letter Word. Fans love these sorts of Easter eggs. You can hear it. You can sort of hear it there. And this is the sort of thing where it's like, oh, you know, it borrows from that song, so this is a reference to Kim Wilde. But the second reason that I think people associate this with her, and this will come up when you do an internet search on it, is because of this particular line. They say you bought a bunch of land somewhere, chose the Rose Garden over Madison Square.
Oh, so Kim Wilde, did TV, right?
About yes, she did.
About gardening.
She
about
did
gardening.
Gardening TV. Boom, you got us there.
What kind of sleuthing is this?
So,
because this,
I can't believe you just randomly remember stuff like that. So this is what happens. She gets pregnant.
There was something weird.
Yeah,
that happened.
I mean, it is, the whole thing's a little strange. She gets pregnant for the first time, And I guess she has some time to think about things besides the entertainment industry as she takes a break. And she gets really into gardening, which it seems more believable and understandable to me post-pandemic, because I briefly got more into gardening. You, I know, got more into gardening during the pandemic.
I'm a gardener, man, yeah.
And she even goes to, does something I don't think you've done, which is she goes to horticultural college. And this gets her a show on British television. The BBC right. gives her a show about gardening. And she writes two books about gardening.
Well, I didn't know that. So I knew she was a TV personality.
Yeah.
Which was weird.
But yeah. she never stops doing music. And this has been a weird thing the media has tried to portray over the years. I think because it's like fits in a box to be like, well, Kim White, she used to rock the kids in America, but now she's rocking the roses or what, you know. I mean, it's a fun story, but it's not actually true. It's also like now we're in 2023 and everybody works on seven different passion projects. You know what I mean? So it's like not weird for someone to be a gardener and a musician and a TV host.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But here's the thing that is weird. If you just want to jump down this with me for a moment.
Right. There's something that's weird about.
The weird thing is that she started spouting all these things about finding aliens in her garden.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She thought there was aliens visiting her in the garden.
It's in the show notes. There's an interview where she just is like, yeah, it's the publication is The Great British Life. She's going to do a show in a town or something, and so they get a phoner with her, and she starts talking about how, yeah, my garden's really great. Also, I've seen aliens back there, and I definitely think that's real. So that's fun. I'm not here to judge. I'm just here to report. That is something that happened.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I don't think it's either one. So if the internet says that it's between those two, I don't think it is. So who do you think it's about?
So, like, I'm glad you asked. I think it's about Bobby Gentry.
Oh, shit. Of course it's totally about Bobby Gentry. It's totally about Roberta Lee Streeter. That's who it is, dude.
It makes sense, right?
Mama said it was a shame about Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. And now Billy Joe McAllister's jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe...
Okay.
Fuck yeah, it is.
Listen.
Oh my god. Oh my gosh.
You guys.
I had a poster, dude. I had a Bobby Gentry poster. I had a Samantha Fox poster and a Bobby Gentry poster in my room.
Listen, I had put this at the bottom of the show notes to make sure we mentioned it. I'm going to mention it now,
bizarre.
Which is if you have not seen the Ed Sullivan Show performance of Bobby Gentry, so. I was watching something else during the research, and the Ed Sullivan Show popped up, and I like jaw dropped.
Arizona, maybe a little bit south of Montgomery. Mama worked in the big house, and Daddy he worked for the county. I never had no learning until I turned 16. When Joe hit me, come up the river, y'all, Lord made a woman out of me. Yes, he did. Lord, he made a woman out of me, yeah.
Like, and I can't even explain it until you see it. First of all, full halter top, 1970 yep. primetime television. Yeah. She's it's not just that she's gorgeous, it is that she is captivating.
Yes.
Captivating. Yes. So yes. so do the history, man. Tell us all about Roberta Lee Streeter.
Roberta is from Mississippi, and she was raised by her grandparents, and they had no electricity or plumbing.
Yeah, right. Remember, we talked about Shania, and we were talking about how important destitute backgrounds are when you're a country music star.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so she has it, like, whether any of this stuff really is true, but she has lore. So there's the thing... It's like Jerry Lee Lewis and the piano or whatever. So it's like her grandmother traded one of the cows for a neighbor's piano.
I believe it. I want to believe it.
And she had a song, and the song that she wrote when she was a little girl was called My Dog Sergeant is a Good Dog, which is a fucking great name of a song,
dude,
for a kid to write on a piano.
Check this shit out. It is
My Dog Sergeant is a Good Dog. That's Bobby Gentry.
It's in the show notes. So I got
curious.
Taylor
Swift wrote a song about Bobby Gentry. This is so true, isn't it?
So it
has to be true.
I wanted to see if My Dog Sergeant Is a Good Dog was ever put to record.
Sergeant, 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 My Dog Sergeant Is a Good Dog. Sergeant, 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 My Dog Sergeant Is a Good Dog. Sergeant, 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 Sergeant.
So, okay, so she leaves Mississippi, so it's one of those things where they know she's talented. So she goes to California with her mom, and they have a group together called Ruby and Bobby Myers. And then she sees a movie, and the last name is Gentry, and she decides to make Gentry her last name.
And then she goes to UCLA, right? Like, not for music. It's for something else.
She goes for philosophy.
That's amazing. It's common story, as I remember it, where she takes some singing gigs while she's in school, and she ends up in Vegas. She ends up going to Vegas and running into somebody backstage. Bob Hope. Oh my God! Can you imagine? And
yeah, think about the time period. Like,
yeah,
who's supposed to be the person that you run into? I don't know. It's got to be pretty unbelievable for a person who no one knows out of nowhere to show up, and all of a sudden Bob Hope sees you in Las Vegas.
Yeah. So then she does music school after that, right?
Yeah. 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 She was the LA Conservatory of Music, and she, there's a guy there, his name is Jody Reynolds, and he went to see a concert at a club. And so she wanted to see, hey, if she could just come sit in on a recording session. And that's really how she gets on recording on tape. Like, she just was bold enough to do that, and she ended up doing a couple of duets with him.
Okay, so we could get really distracted talking about Jody Reynolds. I realize that we are here to talk about Bobby Gentry right now, but this dude has a cool serendipitous route. He's a rockabilly guy who is inspired by Bob Wills and Eddie Arnold, right? But he hears Elvis's Heartbreak Hotel, like, before a gig, and he goes out to his car and he writes a song called Endless Sleep, like, in response to Heartbreak Hotel. And this song becomes his song. So we look it up, Endless Sleep by Jody Reynolds. And then in the mid-70s, so he's inspired by Elvis, writes a song, it becomes the thing that launches his career. And in the mid-70s, Colonel Tom Parker signs him to a deal to write songs for Elvis. But Elvis dies before he gets to perform any of them. And since then, like, you don't think you know Jody Reynolds songs, but they've been covered by, like, the MC5 and Billy Idol and, like, all sorts of random people.
Yeah, so it's bizarre that that's who Bobby Gentry runs into.
It's super weird. That's super weird pairing.
Yeah, yeah. So so then she really wanted to write songs, and so she immediately wrote the Ode to Billy Joe, like, almost immediately. She thinks it's a pretty good song. She wanted to sell the song, so she needed to have a demo, so she couldn't figure out the best way to do it. So she just recorded herself, thinking it was the cheapest way to do it. And it was Capitol who heard it.
Yeah, Capitol is like, holy shit. And this is the thing. If you have not listened to a lot of Bobby Gentry, there is something about that voice. And so Capitol hears it, and they're just like, well, you can just have a recording contract. And so they connect her with a guy that they just brought over from Mercury Records to work on their projects. And his name is Kelly Gordon. And this starts a partnership that's first professional and then romantic for a little while that will actually last the rest of his life. And it will,
dies.
And it'll launch her career.
Right, right. And so that was going to be a B-side.
Another case of this is another thing that keeps coming up, like Mickey Most. People thinking the B-side is the B-side, and it's actually the A-side. Definitely the right move. It does so well, they decide to just take all her demos and make a full record. And Capitol pre-orders 500,000 copies of this record, which at the time is like the largest pressing of a debut album ever.
And think about what's on the charts and what's about to happen.
She replaces Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band at the top of the Billboard 200.
That's right.
Well, and she'll win Grammys. This is just the start of her, right? Yeah, which, you know, they do say is a curse. Best female pop vocal performance. And then she just has this career that happens really fast. Again, I love to point out the timeline in these crazy 60s, 70s, and 80s careers. She duets with Jody at the end of 66, record deal June of 67. Second album comes out in like February of 68. It's all at a breakneck speed.
Right. And so Kelly, her partner, you know, professional and personal, gets the production credit for this. But yeah, so she played all the instruments, the entire thing.
And then she's ascending so quickly, she lands a TV variety show. No gardening, though. This one is just your basic variety show on the BBC.
Yeah.
And she's the first female songwriter to host a series on the network ever. She'll get 6 half-hour episodes. They'll air from July 13th to August 17th. She puts out 2 more albums in 68. So I don't know if you're keeping track at home. That's 3 total albums in 1968. And guess who the third one is with?
She does a duets record with Glenn frickin' Campbell.
Oh, my God. And they're fucking awesome together.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then we get Fancy. That's like 19.
Dude, I fucking love that song. Is that an excuse for me to play the hardcore version of Fancy? Like, I have this metal band from South Carolina who does a... Yeah, I'll play it later.
I was going to say, do you have to ask me for permission to... Can I play the hardcore version of... Yes, you can do that anytime you want to. But then she puts out a record in 71, and then she quits.
She stops making music, new music, but she does this Vegas show. And they did 7 different versions of it in the 70s. And, you know... To go full circle, a few years ago, she knocked Sgt. Pepper's off the Billboard charts. She does a 30-minute Sgt. Pepper segment, quote, that ended with Bobby in a star-decorated trapeze flying above the stage for Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Yeah, it's just totally weird. So, but there's an Ode to Billy Joe movie, which I have seen.
How is it?
It gets an F for film. It's directed by the guy that played Jethro in the Beverly Hillbillies, Max Baker.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. I was going to say, so, Max.
I mean, it's fine, man. You know, like, I don't know. I remember, like I have fond memories of watching it now at this point.
So that's like 78 or something, right? And so then we get to the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and this is where we get to the drama. Things are fairly good, or at least by appearances. May 10th, right. 1981. She gets to be a celebrity guest on this all-star salute to Mother's Day. April of 82, she will attend the Academy of Country Music Awards, and then she essentially disappears.
Vanishes. She's the lucky one. That's the Taylor Swift song.
It's got to be her, right? It's got to be her. So,
oh, it's so awesome.
She has not recorded, performed, or been interviewed since... April of 1982, 11 months before your humble host here was born. Let me read the line again. They still tell the legend of how you disappeared, how you took the money and your dignity and got the hell out. And I think that's interesting. The dignity thing, right? She didn't fade right. away. She didn't make a bunch of compromises. She had a singular, insane career. If you think about TV, Vegas show, duets, 7 albums in the course of 3 years. It's wild. But there's some stuff going on in the background too, right? So she has her first kid in 81. And then remember we talked about this guy, Kelly Gordon?
Yeah.
He dies. He dies right around that time. And I read that she invites him. They're not romantic. They're only romantic for the first few years of her career, as I understand it. And then she's actually married twice after that relationship. But she has him come and live with her. And she like nurses him up until his death. He dies at the age of 48. And there's this great piece in 2008 in The Guardian, written by this guy, Bob Stanley. And he puts it this way. Quote, quite possibly by 1981, Gentry thought there were other things to do with the rest of her life that would be more satisfying than constantly thinking up new costumes, new routines, and new ways of avoiding besotted fans. She left on her own terms. But there's also this like bigger picture to consider. He quotes a DJ at WFMU, a woman named Sheila B.
WFMU kicks ass.
When I saw the quote, I was like, well, that's going in because Murdoch's going to love it. Quote, obviously, there are many factors behind success, but in 1967, America was clearly not ready to roll out the red carpet for the female artist who wrote, played, and produced her own material. I think she's got a point.
Well, I mean, think about when it was.
Yeah.
It's pre-70.
Yeah. And, you know, this guy, Bob, who wrote this article in The Guardian, goes on to make another point, getting a little more into her biography, and says, quote, at almost every turn in her story, there's a man who feels slighted. There's Bobby Paris, a credited producer on Ode to Billy Joe, who kept photos of Gentry with her face scratched out.
Oh my gosh.
There's Jim Ford, who was an ex-boyfriend who claimed he wrote Ode to Billy Joe, and his supposed evidence was that she never wrote another song that was as big a hit, but neither did he. She could write, produce, design sets, costumes. She could pretty much do everything, and she liked to work alone. And I think that's the key sentence. She could do it on her own. And at a certain point, defending yourself for not needing the help would get exhausting.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much more of a better case we can make of her being way ahead of her time, right?
Well, 60s, 70s entertainment biz definitely did not know how to conceptualize or understand a woman as strong, sexy, opinionated, talented, and in charge as she is. This is a quote from a 1974 interview. So this is, what is that, 7 years before the disappearance? 8 years? Quote, yeah. I am a woman working for herself in a man's field. Notice that phrase again. Working for herself. I am a successful woman and record producer. I took Ode to Billy Joe to Capitol. I sold it and produced the album myself, even though Kelly gets credit if you go look today. It wasn't easy. It's difficult when a woman is attractive. Beauty is supposed to negate intelligence, which is ridiculous. Certainly, there are no women executives and producers to speak of in the record business. She's calling people out in 1974. And so then she calls the ultimate shot in 1982, and she just quits with no warning.
So I knew it was her because she split. But where'd she go? Because I don't know where she went.
So literally no one in the wider, like, non-personally related to her or like super close friend sense, no one knew for a really long time. For over 30 years, she was just basically like, I think there was a contingent of people that had thought maybe she had died or something had happened to her. But in 2016, there's a Washington Post reporter named Neely Tucker who takes a stab at trying to figure out what might have happened to Bobby. And this is what she comes back with. Quote, the short answer to one of pop's great mysteries, Bobby Gentry lives about a two-hour drive from the site of the Tallahatchie Bridge that made her so famous. She lives in a gated community in a very nice house that costs about $1.5 million. Her neighbors, a few locals, and some real estate agents know who she is, although it's not clear which of her many possible names she might go by. So this piece goes on to ask how you disappear from the limelight, which is actually a pretty good question, though I think the first thing I would say is, like, it would be very different now with all of the different digital and other footprints that you leave, right? This is the early 80s, but the article says this, quote, a complicated family history, a stage name, a couple of short-lived marriages, and a false birth date on her official PR material helped. Plus, Gentry's family didn't talk, and she had cut off nearly all her friends in the music business. When reporters would reach out through intermediaries, there was just never a reply. She just straight up said, no, I'm done. And it's funny, if you want to go read that article, the Washington Post, it's actually pretty short, because what happens is the reporter starts looking at, like, Google Maps, I guess, and, like, figures out, because she hears these rumors of, like, where they think Bobby Gentry is, and she can find a shot of the house.
Yeah, figures it out.
And then she's able to cross-reference the address with a phone number and finds a phone number. And so she calls the phone number. And a woman picks up very politely, and she introduces herself and says the newspaper's name, and the woman hangs up. And so she ends saying, after, you know, 30-something years, I'm pretty sure I made contact with Bobby Gentry, but I think that's it.
Wow. Did you ever listen to the Mercury Rev record? It was called the Bobby Gentry, the Delta's Sweetie Revisited. It was like the reimagining of Bobby Gentry's
Is
forgotten
it good?
Masterpiece. It's okay. I like other Mercury Rev stuff better, but it's kind
of
cool.
I mean,
but,
there's all sorts of influence, right? And all sorts of like speculation from other musicians about
Joseph Buell.
Yeah, Joseph Buell had that song. What was that called?
Where's Bobby Gentry?
Beth Orton recorded a song that was on the other side of Daybreak called, I think it's just called Bobby Gentry.
Bobby Gentry.
And, you know, in 2012, a country star on the verge of becoming one of the biggest names in pop music history stands on a metaphorical precipice on the back end of an album modeled after Joni Mitchell and Kim Wilde, and she pays tribute to the legend of how you disappeared and how you took the money and your dignity and you got the hell out.
I think I am a Swiftie at this point. Because being connected to Bobby Gentry is good enough for
me. She's the lucky one. Hey, if you've got a rumor, if you've heard some innuendo, if you need a research team, this is what we do, man. We don't even charge for it. Send us a note. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. And remember that we have your shot at going to a Kick-Ass
Louder
Music Festival.
Life.
Dude, what? Like, tell me three bands that you want to see at Louder Than Life off the top of your head.
Well, let's see. Pantera. Who do you want to see?
I'm going to make sure that you and I together get to watch Fever 333.
Okay.
I've never seen Fever 333, but their frontman, Jason, was in a band called Let Live, who I did see and was absolutely blown away. And I have heard that Fever 333 is next level, like even better than Let Live. Also, I mean, we got to see Turnstile, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm glad they're on a big stage. Good for them, too.
It's going to be a good time. Check out that full lineup and tell us the five bands you want to see. You can find the link in a link tree on our Instagram. You can find it when you go to wearethestoryguys.com. You'll find a link there to the side to play the contest. Just all you got to do is go fill out the information, put the five acts you want to see, and we might all be at the music festival together. Wouldn't that be magical? You can make some rock and roll bedtime stories of your own. Some rumor, some innuendo. Yeah, you can make it happen right here in Louisville, Kentucky. Meanwhile, patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories if you want to support the show. Instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories if you want to get involved on the social. And what should people keep doing until next time, Murdoch?
Keep telling stories. Saw the tears welling up in her troubled eyes as she started to